Continuing the interview with Bud Wilson on July 30th, 1997, you were just saying that the Japanese were facing a situation with the coking coal.
Well, the coal they were purchasing from Utah was the lowest cost and the highest quality coking coal available to the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
So they would, well, they did on several occasions lean over backwards to see that our demands were, if not met in total, were at least understood.
Or demands.
Well,
O-R-E, right?
Our demands.
Our, that's what I'm, okay.
And just really for price increase, price relief.
Right. But you don't like to push them into that spot too often.
No, you can't do that often. But the relationship with Japanese steel mills in those days was very good.
Were you still dealing with Mitsui?
Mitsubishi had a small interest in the coal mines. And they were the trading company through which all of the coal was supplied to the steel industry.
What were the Australians asking for? What was the problem?
Well, you know, I'd have to do some research on that. I remember an incident that I'll relate, which might explain part of it at least. When the strike started, I went to Australia and had arranged to have lunch at Blackwater Mine with the head of the coal miners union.
Mm-hmm.
The coal miners union were headquartered in Sydney. So we met at the lunch table with some of our lieutenants on each side. I put out my hand to shake hands and welcome him, and he put his hand in his pocket.
Oh my.
And he said, "Mr. Wilson, before we go any further, I want you to know that I'm a member of the Communist Party, and I see my job as not to reach understanding with companies, but my job is to frustrate them." So that's the way we started once.
Oh my goodness. A little different from the French.
Yeah.
My. So
that's what we had to put up with. The coal miners union was a communist dominated union, and they just delighted in making trouble.
So there was
not only for us, but for everyone else. But we were prime targets because we were foreign owned.
Sure. You can hardly negotiate with someone who has an attitude like
there
that.
There was no negotiation.
No negotiation,
no.
No.
Not at all.
Oh my. Huh. Well, we've had a little interruption while Bud discussed his travel arrangements to go grouse shooting in Scotland next week, so we're going to have to go back now to Australia.
Well, I think we've finished Australia.
Yeah. Okay.
I think really we were talking
right.
about General Electric Company in
yeah.
those early days.
But
a couple of the problems that I had with them that Settling on strike was one of the...
No, that was...
Settling an antitrust lawsuit was another.
But what was that about?
Westinghouse sued the uranium producers for alleging that the uranium producers had come together and conspired to fix prices. And I was named in the suit. As they had, the Westinghouse attorneys had found in our files during the discovery procedures, memorandum from me to the fellow who was selling uranium, which memorandum said, in essence, don't sell uranium at the current prices.
This was to your person in your company?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was taken as a, Westinghouse lawyers said, there's proof that this guy is part of the conspiracy. Mm-hmm. So during my deposition, I made it pretty clear that I was not part of a conspiracy, that I had stopped the sale of uranium at the current prices because Shirley Basin couldn't make any money, was losing money. Mm-hmm. Question was asked, well, why didn't you, your engineers had given you a cost estimate that proved that you could have made money? And I said, I didn't believe the cost estimate. I didn't think they were capable of giving me a good estimate. Well, anyway, we were not a party to a conspiracy. We had never been, and to my knowledge, I had no knowledge of any such undertaking amongst the uranium producers. But by golly, I got a telephone from Reg Jones. I was at the Connaught Hotel in London waiting to go on to Edinburgh to shoot grouse one time. And Jones said, settle the suit. Mm. Gee whiz. So I called Littlefield, and then he called Jones, and we were forced to settle. And it, gee whiz, that was just, settling a suit is, to my mind, was tantamount to saying we shared some guilt. Mm-hmm. We did not. As I recall, those are the only two significant problems I had with Jones.
Wasn't there supposed to have been some meeting in Johannesburg?
Yeah, it was a meeting of the uranium producers. There was some society or... Mm-hmm.
Were you there?
No, I wasn't there.
Oh.
Perhaps one of my fellows was there. Yeah. I don't know.
That was supposed to be one of the places where they...
Yeah. See, Westinghouse had contracted to fuel some power plants at a price that they couldn't...
Fuel some what?
Fuel some nuclear plant.
Yes.
But at a price that was lower than their costs, and they were attempting to find some way to
mm-hmm.
get it get at the producer to decrease the price.
And Jones wanted to settle.
Yeah, Jones was really, anything that got the security analyst agitated, Jones became agitated. This for me was a real pain in the neck, because I had been used to, at that time, essentially running my own show, at least. Doing what I thought was right, and to have a guy like Jones. I know I shouldn't say a guy like Jones. Reg Jones is a fine man. But he had General Electric Company shareholders to consider. And so that put him on a different track. But otherwise, Jones was easy to get along with.
You would think that he wouldn't be that anxious to please Westinghouse, a long history of antagonism.
Well, anyway, I think you look at the lawsuits that GE has been involved in, particularly anything having to do with price fixing. You know, they got under Jones's one of the former chairmen, GE had an awful time with the price fixing antitrust suit. And so any time an antitrust suit was brought against General Electric Company, GE would attempt to find some reasonable way to settle it rather than fight it in court.
You've been grouse shooting for a long time then.
Yeah, sure.
You were able to keep on with that even through all this.
Yeah, and really the instigator of that was a man to whom I reported directly under NGE, the vice chairman of General Electric Company, Jack Parker.
Oh.
And Parker and I became good friends. And see each other often, go hunting and fishing together, shooting. Well, it was interesting fallout from that relationship.
Yeah. You were meeting these people only now and then, I take it, when you went back east for these. You mentioned Jones's monthly meetings.
Yeah, once a month.
The executive council. Was that a, how'd you feel about that?
How'd I feel about it? Well, I felt very uncomfortable, but something had to be done. You know, it was strange to me, strange management. different way of going about business. I tried to, I did my best to be seen by the GE executives as trying to do what they wanted done. It went along pretty well under the Jones regime. He essentially let Utah run its own business for these, except for these two things that I mentioned here. And
you did very well for GE.
Yeah, we did. When Jones retired and Welch took over, Parker retired.
When was that?
Well,
let's see. Welch came in 1981.
Oh, it was just been on that. Yeah. 1981.
So, Jones, I guess, why did he just reach the age of retirement? Is that what happened to Jones?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Okay.
But Jack Parker was the GE executive who was responsible for Utah. And Jack, having a much better understanding of businesses with long lead times, he had developed the jet engine business in General Electric Company, among others. He had a very quickly acquired an understanding of our business that was not shared by others in General Electric Company. So when Jack retired at the same time that Jones did, then comes along a new management team at General Electric Company. Jack Welch, chairman, John Burlingame, vice chairman. Ed Hood, vice chairman. I reported Burlingame, who was, Burlingame, a pretty nice guy, but Jack Welch was a fellow of a very different stripe. Jack made it clear when he first took over that he didn't like the mining business. He didn't like Utah, and he didn't like the people working for Utah. That's the way we began to associate with each other.
My word. How did he express this?
Just as I expressed it to you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on an airplane, flying from San Francisco to White Plains.
Oh, my.
Welch had had a good deal to drink at that point, and I think perhaps had he not, he would have put a little more. When we had a meeting in Florida, when it was Jack Welch's appointment as chairman was announced, and Jim Curry, who was my chief finance officer at the time, was at the meeting, and somehow, some way, Jim Curry crossed Jack Welch. And Jack took me aside and at night, you know. And geez, Jack was full of booze.
Mm.
And that was a matter I had to tussle with all the time.
Mm.
And, we were, it became, you know, Jack publicly, Welch said, I'm setting up the company to run with its independent units. They will make the decisions. That's baloney. Welch made every decision involving the people and the things throughout the company. Welch did a marvelous job, is doing a marvelous job of generating the company. But boy, I tell you, from a personal standpoint, he's a tough guy to work for. And he was so set on getting Curry out of the company that we'd have every, I guess, annual meetings about people evaluation. And he was on me for 2 years about that. And finally, John Burlingame said, if you want to save Curry, you have to get him out of the country where Jack doesn't see him. So, okay, we decided, I decided to send Jim to Australia to put him in overall charge of the coal mines and the Australian activities. Welch heard about that and he said no. Welch said, you put Ralph Long as head of the activities and have Jim report into him.
Mm.
Well, that made Curry furious when he learned that he would be reporting to Ralph Long. We had an office set up. Actually, Keith Wallace had set it up in Sydney. So we had...
Yeah, you had just changed your...
Beg your pardon?
You had just moved your headquarters to Sydney recently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, we had set Keith Wallace out there. And then I put Ralph Long in Sydney and Curry in Brisbane. You know, to this day, Jim bears a grudge against me for that, for having what I suppose he saw as lack of confidence in him.
Mm.
I never told him that I did that to save him from Jack Welch.
Oh, dear.
Oh, man, I tell you, Jack made my life miserable.
Must have. Was his drinking a problem?
I don't think it was a problem.
No.
But he would, you know, he'd say some of the darndest things, at least did to me.
Hmm.
He made it clear that he didn't like Jack Parker. One time, you know, I had to, when we had an investment opportunity analyzed, and you know, I'd have to run the General Electric Company with it. But we had a anthracite coal property on in Zululand in South Africa.
Mm.
And it looked like that a pretty good business could be developed in selling anthracite for fuel in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And we had did all of our engineering, our cost estimating, market surveys, all the things you do. And here is a, I don't know what this thing's going to cost, $100 million maybe. So So I took the proposition to the executive council, and headed by Welch. First I took it through Burlingame, and he thought it sounded okay. I cleared it with him, and anyway, took it there. Meeting with Welch, Burlingame, and Ed Hood. I'll never forget this. Ed Hood would watch Welch, and if Welch frowned, Hood would frown. If he smiled, Hood smiled. And I went through my song and dance. Welch looked at me, and he said, "I hate you white hunters."
Oh my.
Yeah. Referring to Parker and me. Africa, our interest in Africa. This was a time when some of the public was getting down on Africa and getting on to publicly owned companies doing business in Africa. So Welch saw us as putting him on the spot, I think. Yeah. That was his response. That was the end of the anthracite deal.
Oh my. Now, disvestiture was the code term.
That was a key word in those days.
Right, at that time.
And, you know, I guess I didn't have the feel of it in those days. Certainly I was not sensitive to the investor relations side of the business, perhaps as I should have been. But gee, I tell you, Jack was a hell of a guy to work for. Man. We had the Escondida property. I think by this time, we had spent about $87 million in drilling Escondida.
That was in Chile.
Chile, yeah. And we were, by 1980, 81, we're getting pretty close to developing, finalizing our engineering and cost estimating and developing a plan for bringing Escondida into production. And it was going to cost something like $1.2 billion, some such a modest sum. Jack was just nervous as hell, and he finally said, "I won't do it. I just forget about bringing that to me." He said, I don't like the business. So I don't want to be part of it." And that's when the sale of Utah the sale of Utah was decided at a meeting that I had with Welch. Told me that he was going to sell Utah, hoped to keep it in as a business unit. If he couldn't find a buyer, he would sell the assets, but he wanted to keep it as in, and he thought he could make more money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure. I think it was Burlingame who approached BHP. Mm-hmm. I think he did that after I told him that I thought BHP would be the most logical buyer of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
So Burlingame essentially negotiated a deal with BHP.
Pretty remarkable that you were able to stick that out.
Well, you know, when GE acquired Utah, I did a little research and found that the average life expectancy of the head of an acquired company was 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured I was going to be out in 5 years. I developed vineyards and I was going to go into the farming business. Well, you know, I was fortunate enough to tough it out. Oh, there are many times I would have folded up, thrown in the towel, and said, heck with it. But I knew if I did so, then the people who were working for me, you know, would be subjected to all this GE stuff. Would have been unpleasant. So I stuck it out. And, then when the BHP deal came along, altogether different story. You know, now Utah is owned by a company that is involved in the natural resource business, understands it, wants it.
Mm-hmm.
Thought the people working for Utah were the best people in the world, and.
That's quite a different attitude, isn't it?
Boy, I should say. That's a different story.
But Jim didn't stay with BHP very long, though. No. But that's his story, I guess. But he did. You did keep him with GE all that time. He stayed through and then succeeded you.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe the next session we'll get into that story.
Well, that comes in. But what about Escondido? We haven't. This is the first mention you've made of it. How did that come about?
Well, Escondido, you mean how did what come about?
Yeah, I mean, did you do exploration and find it, or did you acquire it? Or?
Oh, no. I think probably in. We started a program that was proposed to us by a consulting geologist whose name escapes me at the moment, who had a theory that the Chilean copper deposits were formed at intersections of faults, minor faults, transverse to the major fault that has a name, runs almost the length of Chile. So our head of exploration came to me with this, explained the theory, and explained that the proposition was that we would fund wildcat drilling, that these fault intersections would be identified and we'd just drill one fault intersection after another. And the deal with the consultant was that should we be successful, then we'd pay him $5 million should we bring out, find something that was, we would bring in a production, we'd pay him $5 million. The second fault intersection we drilled, we hit Escondida.
My goodness.
Man, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
For Mining Man, that Escondida was the greatest thing that could happen. You know, when we completed the drilling, we had identified I think it's over 759 million tons of 1.63% copper, which is a, geez, for a mining guy, that's a bonanza, you know. And then the protor, the stuff underneath, you know, there was a couple of billion tons of 0.9%, 0.9 copper.
0.9?
Mm-hmm. Which is twice the grade of Kennecott, for example, you know?
Mm.
Gee.
Well, it still is the most exciting copper mine in the world.
It is, yeah. It's certainly the largest producer and the most profitable.
The richest,
yeah.
And biggest. And
yeah. That was fun to put together. We put that together under BHP.
Uh-huh. But you already had it.
Well, we had it, but it was, the decision was made to bring the ore body in production under a general electric company. By that time, you know, Jack Parker was on the board. And when we went to the Utah board, right, the deal with BHP was that Utah board had $10 million. They could make their own decision. But anything in excess of $10 million had to be referred to the BHP board.
BHP?
BHP board. Now, this is now BHP.
And
owns Utah.
Parker, yes.
And
but
Parker
went on the
was on the Utah board.
Oh, okay, all right.
And when Brian Lowden, who was then the chairman of BHP, I guess Brian and chief finance officer, think of that for a minute.
I've got it somewhere, but
when it was, the plan was laid out to the Utah board, and Lowden and Jeff Healy was his chief finance officer. Lowden and Healy were shocked at the price, at the cost, and shocked at the whole idea. As a matter of fact, they probably didn't know where Chile was. Jack Parker looked at Lowden in the eye and he said, some to the effect that any mining company that turned this deal down doesn't deserve to be a mining company.
Mm-hmm. But GE wouldn't have,
no,
wouldn't have gone anywhere with it.
I had Littlefield tell me later that he, after three or four years ago, BHP made BHP's share of the Escondido profits exceeded $1 billion.
Mm.
I guess $1 billion Australian, which is say $750,000 US. And he told that to Welch, and Welch said he just didn't have the courage to get it something like that. Welch and the GE people want controller markets, controller pricing. And in the mining business, particularly in commodities like copper, you don't control the price. You make your money out of the mines by being the lowest cost producer. If you're the lowest cost producer, you've got it made.
Mm-hmm.
But that philosophy is something that General Electric Company just could not bring themselves to understand. And of course, there's no background in mining. They didn't know whether we were being factual or feeding them baloney, so.
They were cautious.
Yeah, they were cautious.
Mm.
But under BHP, the whole, all the relationships, the pressure was off, because now we had an owner that understood the mining business, wanted to expand the mining business. And from a personal standpoint, they made it clear that they thought I'd done a heck of a good job in Australia. And the other Utah folks like Keith Wallace and Ralph Long, others had done a fine job, and they respected them.
Mm-hmm.
All the other different let's get into that next time.
Yeah, we'll wait with that. okay, well, I guess that really... Now, the shipping was still, you had the mining and the shipping.
We kept the shipping under, kept the ships and the organization while we were General Electric Company. When we went into BHP, then that was all transferred into the BHP
but you had
shipping organization.
You had been overseeing, running all of the mining and the shipping as
yeah.
well. And that, I guess, that was, that's enough, but that was it, right?
Yeah, that was it.
Mm-hmm. But now, I've got a note here that says that even before you went with BHP, that you were negotiating oil acquisitions for them in the U.S.?
For them? Right. No, that's not correct. We, the lab organization made one acquisition in this company in Kansas City. But it wasn't until we got the BHP that they decided to expand.
But you had had, of course, plenty of contact, I suppose, with BHP in Australia. You must have run into them in the coal business.
Oh, sure did.
Yeah. But that was the way that you knew them. Would you like to?
Well, they knew us too. There was a year the sure. Utah Development Company, which was our the name under which the corporation under which we operated in Australia, made more money than BHP made. So, we were known to them.
Yes. Well, I'm sure. Well, do you want to be philosophical for just a few minutes?
Why don't we be philosophical after we get through with
okay.
the PhD?
All right. I just see a little thing here that says authoritarian.
The what?
I've got a little note here, or a little thing here about authoritarian leadership. It sounds as if you had plenty of that at GE. That's authoritarian to the extreme, isn't it? But, well, I think it's remarkable that you were able to stick that out. How many years was it? Was more
well,
than
76 to 84.
So it was a lot more than, almost twice the five that
yeah.
you anticipated.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those were tough years, I'll tell you.
I'm sure. Okay, well, do you want to call it quits for today then?
Up to you. Four.
Well, it's a good, probably a good stopping
think
place.
So?
What do you think?
All right, that's fine with me.
All right. We might just, this is forecasting what. But were you getting into any of your community activities at this time here? Or did you have any time at all for?
Yeah, I was involved in some San Francisco things. Like I was one year I was the chairman of the United Way, San Francisco United Way.
That's a big job.
That took a lot of time, but I had some good help.
Mm-hmm.
I served on the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce for a number of years.
That's sort of expected of you, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so.
Littlefield did, has done, still does a lot in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Did you follow with any of his favorite things?
No,
or did
I
you
really
develop
yeah.
your own?
Be pardon?
You developed your own?
Yeah, I did.
Mm-hmm.
And not, you know, not consciously. Ed and I work well together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could probably detect that what I've said that while Ed had apparently had confidence in me and let me
mm-hmm.
pretty well run my own business.
Mm-hmm.
Ed tended the financial side of the business, but let me handle the operating side,
mm-hmm.
which suited me.
Worked just fine.
Worked fine, you bet.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Mm.
he and I working together made a lot of people rich, you know. That was said by one of the Eccles clan one time when
they benefited handsomely.
We were at a party in Ogden. Ed and I walked in the room, or Bev and I walked in the room, and somebody said, "Oh, you're the folks that have made us rich."
That's true. Very true. When did you start your interest in the I Institute?
Well, that came about through a lawyer who was a partner of Pillsbury Madison Sutro, who handled Utah's account there, Harry Harrell. And Harry was, had known the Kettleballs, and Smith was Guy F. Atkinson. Owner, part owner. And so when the Research Foundation was put together, Harry was its legal counsel and a director. And sometime, I suppose it was about 1980, that I joined the Smith Kettleball board at Harry's recommendation. And it's the only such board that I've been on where the directors were not obligated to raise money for that.
It was a
funded enterprise, and really quite interesting.
Well, it's been a wonderful thing. Are you still on it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Been a long time.
Matter of fact, I'm vice president.
Oh, are you? Good.
I think that means that next year they want me to be president, but I'm afraid I'll have to. I have to decline. I just don't want to be that involved.
Really?
Time.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of all sorts of reasons not to travel to San Francisco. But I do enjoy Smith Kettleball. Working with scientists and doctors is something that I find very interesting, and boy, there's sure a lot of sharp people involved in that enterprise.
Well, the developments in eye ophthalmology in the last few years have been incredible.
Sure.
Very exciting. Must be very gratifying to be a part of it.
Well, it's interesting, gratifying, I don't know, because you don't really, from, the only thing the board contributes is watching the money. That's the board's function. We meet quarterly. At each meeting, we have lunch with the staff, and various of them put on little show and tells for us, keep us in the picture of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's important. keep them on track?
The good people. I just, you know, I get a big, I just really like to be associated with people who are very good at what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, that crowd is very good.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was other things that you were sort of civic things that you were getting into. Well, you said you started planting vines at your ranch, but you started planting vines at your ranch.
Yeah, well, I thought I was going to be out of a job.
Do you still have wine?
Still have part. I sold off quite a few of the wine grape part of the operation.
That's as chancy as copper.
Oh, God, it's worse than copper. It's worse than wine. You have no control over market, production, weather. It's awful.
Yeah.
Bugs.
When did you become a friend of Bill Hewlett?
When he joined the board of Utah, back, well, I don't know, I guess before I became. Yeah, he was on the board well before the GE acquisition. Mm-hmm. We had some great guys on board. Hewlett, R.J. Miller, former president of Ford Motor Company. He came on the board and he came out here to head the Stanford Business School.
Mm-hmm.
This was Ed Littlefield who brought them on the
mm-hmm.
board.
Who were some of the other board members?
Who
were some of the other board members? Was Biagini on you?
No, no, Ben was not, not a director of Utah.
Hmm.
But we had the family directors, you know, the...
Mm-hmm. Dee and Wattis.
And Eccles.
Eccles.
George Eccles until he passed away.
Did you bring anybody on?
Ken Durr, who was chairman of, head of Chevron.
Was he your
yeah,
recruit?
Him. Uh-huh. I recruited him. I guess I also recruited
do that next time. Okay, well, we've done a good job today. So, we'll be pondering between now and tomorrow morning.
I'll try to ponder, yeah.
All right.
We'll talk tomorrow, we'll talk about BHP.
Yes.
Yeah.